Most people understand why climate change matters. Extreme heat, rising seas, and tail risks from everything from food prices to national security to hurricanes. But once you accept the why, the difficult question becomes how. How do you actually decarbonize the US economy? How do you actually build things like solar projects in a country that barely builds anything at all? And how do you navigate the tricky politics of climate under a president that's hostile to the energy transition? Today I'm talking to Robinson Meyer. He's a founder and executive editor of Heatmap News. He's also a columnist here at The Argument and my former colleague from The Atlantic. He happens to be one of the smartest and most talented climate policy journalists around. The old debates about whether climate change is real are over. After decades of theorizing, we're actually starting to try and decarbonize the US economy. And it turns out that's just as hard and just as contested as the science ever was. My name is Jerusalem Demsis. I'm the founder and editor of The Argument, a magazine dedicated to revitalizing liberalism for the 21st century. On this podcast, we bring together everyone from socialists to conservatives to talk about the biggest issues of the day. The Argument is against subtweeting. We state our opinions clearly and we confront our opponents directly. For an ad-free version of this episode, you can become a subscriber at theargumentmag.com. Rob, welcome to the show.
I'm so excited to be here.
So first, welcome to my living room. And I do have to clarify, this is not my actual living room. There are viewers and who believe this to be my living room now, but we are actually in an office space.
This is, I think of it as your audiovisual living room.
My audiovisual living room.
Exactly. Yeah. It's your spiritual living room.
Exactly. Thank you. And I mean, it has like, these are my actual books, but these are various accoutrements, which are not mine actually. So, I want to be honest with the public.
Also, I would say I've lived in situations where this would be larger than any space I could call a living room. And so really, you know, if it were a living room, that would be great.
You're in New York now, so you're used to this
exactly.
shit. So we're here to talk about the politics of climate, which is a very simple topic.
Yeah, it's
exciting.
Not nerve-wracking.
But I want to start because I think that there's usually a like unspoken, it's obvious that we all care about climate view from a lot of climate activists and a lot of people who themselves already care about climate change. And I think that like that's actually a view that like needs to be interrogated more about whether it's true that like widespread people do believe that climate is a top issue that people should care about, but also just the why behind it. Because I think that that's often, it's unspoken too much. And I think that people often don't actually know the reasons behind why it's an important issue or should be an important issue for a lot of us. And so we recently published here at The Argument a piece by Alex Trembath, who is a contributor for us. And he wrote a very controversial piece, which was that voters don't care about climate change and they're right not to. And his piece really focuses on both the public opinion research we have showing that while voters will say that, yes, they think that climate change is real and that it's man-made, that they think it's an issue that the government should address, if they're asked to rank their issues, if they're asked about what issues they would want to spend money on, whether they're willing to spend serious amounts of political capital or of their own finances on combating climate change, it's pretty clear, survey after survey, the answer is no. They don't want to see that. So, Rob, convince them. Convince the voters of America. Why should we care about climate change?
Well, I think we should care about climate change for a few reasons. I mean, I think I have to say, I think it's actually kind of interesting you're starting with this question because this is a question that, candidly, I would say I haven't been asked for a long time.
Yeah.
And it's not even where my kind of repertorial focus looks at anymore, which is just to say that I don't know how good a job I'll be able to do with this. But I would say that there's three big reasons to care about climate change, or there's kind of three big reasons I think about caring about climate change in my head. The first reason is that climate change is going to make it harder to live in many different parts of the world, particularly parts of the world where a lot of people are very poor.
Mm-hmm.
And it is going to hold back people's development.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to make it harder to be outside and to work outside for hours of the day as we get pushed deeper into the century.
I mean, you're already seeing this in like Phoenix or really hot places where construction workers are demanding that you don't have to work outside in like 120 degrees weather. And I mean, it's debilitating.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. I think that's the first reason.
Mm-hmm.
I would say, and through that lens, that's often discussed as kind of climate change will be bad for people who are especially exposed to, let's say, the vagaries of the world, which is mostly poor people, especially the kind of global poor.
People who can't adapt.
People who can't adapt, exactly. So that's like one group. I would say the second reason to care about climate change is that climate change could impose large tail risks on global society that we don't fully understand. And we may not ever fully understand those tail risks until we encounter them for the first time. Mm-hmm. You know, the global climate is a is full of feedback loops and systems that we may not fully be able to comprehend until we kind of run the experiment and discover that, in fact, sending CO2 levels higher than they've been in millions of years is a big mistake.
Yeah.
And
like the models of that are like, we're just huge uncertainty bands. Like, we don't really know what it looks like to have a world like that and have human life in the way we have right now.
Yes. I mean, I would say that there's like a few different points of view here, and we're at the edge of kind of how I've thought about this lately. So I would say, first of all, there were a number of feedback loops we were really worried about 5 years ago that we are slightly less worried about now, such as there were risks of kind of rapid sea level rise in tens of feet that we could face by 2100. Some of those risks have now been pushed out past 2100. Now, let me say, by the way, that 2100 is like an awfully arbitrary point in time to care about. And 2100 has gone, even in the course of kind of modern climate politics, from being a date that was far enough in the future that we couldn't really fathom it, to being a date that, like, people born this year will likely see. You know, like, people are living now who are going to see 2100.
Yeah.
And that wasn't even true, you know, at... Or I don't think that was true in the same way.
Yeah.
Even in 2005 or 2012, you know, when there were, we had previous moments of kind of excitement or attention to climate policy. I think, that being said, you know, and I'm summarizing vast swaths of scientific literature that, frankly, I've been so focused on policy lately that I've not, like, quite gone back and checked. But I would say that when I was doing more reporting on climate science, you could see disagreements between different groups of climate scientists around tail risks as well. So, for instance, like, folks who kind of look, who do modeling, who look at what are the risks of... What can we kind of estimate? What are the error bars that, given physical models, like computer programs that input basic physics about how the environment works, tend to be actually slightly less concerned. They're still very concerned, but they tend to be slightly less concerned than paleoclimatologists who study the climates of the past.
Yeah.
Because paleoclimatologists are used to, when they look in climates of the past, to seeing very rapid dislocations in the Earth's climate. And who are also aware that, like, we are putting Earth's CO2 levels toward a place they haven't been in all of human history and millions of years. So the other point I would make about the kind of tail risk argument that I think can tie into broader arguments about and broader conversations about climate policy is that it became quite fashionable to talk about climate policy through the lens of this is going to hurt the most, what's the word we would use? The most vulnerable populations in the world, right? That climate policy is something, and climate change is something we should take on because it's going to be worst for poor people, for people of color, for homeless people, right? Which I think could be true. I also think tail risks of the kind that we worry about with climate change are actually going to be bad for everyone.
I mean, and this I think is to like some degree to like, I mean, like wildfire risk, right?
Yes, exactly.
I mean, this is something where like the Palisades is not like a poor community.
No, the Palisades is a very wealthy community.
Yes.
And in fact, the way the Palisades fire is now going to feed through into like imposing costs on society is like people are going to have to pay higher home insurance rates.
Yep.
Someone is going to have, you know, someone in the California financial ecosystem is going to have to pay to like restring that entire local electrical grid. There's a great reporter, Jake Biddle at Grist, who's done reporting on how actually lower income communities, when they've been affected by wildfire, tend to rebuild faster because
it's cheaper to rebuild.
It's cheaper to rebuild because people don't have the same ambitions for their home necessarily. They don't have the same budget to rebuild their home. They don't see their home getting burned down as like an opportunity to kind of build the structure they've always wanted, which means they need all these, you know, separate, you know, permits and such. They
just, well, like, there's a moment where I have to shit on California.
I know exactly. You know what I mean? But like, what I want to say is just like, there are slow marginal costs that are actually going to hit everyone. And then there's also these big tail risks, and those will also affect everyone too. And in fact, the more exposed you are, because the more wealth you have or the more assets you have, you're going to feel it as well. And then the last reason to care about climate change, which, you know, we kind of don't talk about anymore and that doesn't get talked about as much, is like, climate change is going to be really bad for the natural world.
Yeah.
And in fact, the impacts of the natural world will be some of the hardest and longest to recover from. Yeah. And so,
I mean, they don't have infrastructure development.
They don't have infrastructure. Yeah. They don't have societies, you know, like, and, you know, we can look in the geological record and see that during previous moments of climatological dislocation, like, the world has suffered in the past, which isn't to say that we're in a mass extinction, but like, because I don't think we are in a mass extinction yet. It would take another several hundred years of like extinctions at current rates to see a mass extinction. But
that was a subtweet, by the way, audience.
No, it was. Well, no, I mean, like,
we don't subtweet here, Rob.
It's that the loss of biodiversity is actually the last thing you rebuild.
Yeah.
And you rebuild it totally outside of human timescale. So there are tropical coral reefs right now, right? Beautiful ecosystems that house some huge share of oceanic biodiversity. We can go back in the fossil record and see that there have been tropical coral reefs in the past. And those tropical coral reefs have been eliminated in the past.
Yeah.
And it took like 10 million years to get them back.
Yeah.
Now, 10 million years is like about, you know, 1/6 of the time that has passed since the dinosaurs went extinct, except for birds. And so it's a very, very long period of time. It goes past any kind of recognizable human time scale. Yeah. And so when you lose biodiversity, you lose a huge amount of you never get that back.
Yeah. So I think that's super helpful. And I think that, like, given, I mean, obviously there's like a world of scientific literature that you're, you know, summarizing for us here. And I think that, you know, but like, laying that out, I think genuinely is useful, because I think that often a lot of those things get cross, like almost like conversation gets cross contaminated. Like, we're talking about like what's going to happen to sea level rise hurting developing nations. And then all of a sudden we're talking about polar bears. And I think that people often get like, what are all these different things? Are all these different things the same thing about CO2? Are some of these things different? And I do think it's helpful to like sort them out so people can decide, you know, there's some people who just are like, yeah, okay, that's like sad about the coral reefs, but I'm not going to put much time or effort into like saving that.
I think
it's
a valid argument to say like, that's fine. I think humans are more important and like human flourishing is more important.
But I do think like there are good arguments at the point for like why human flourishing is at risk, you know? So I think that now we know why we should care about climate change, but I want to talk about the politics of climate, which I think are actually as thorny as the science itself. The biggest climate bill of our lifetimes was the Inflation Reduction Act, passed in 2022 under Joe Biden. And I know in your world, this is old news, but I think a lot of people actually don't know a lot about what the IRA did or was. So can we just start there? What was the IRA? What did it do?
Yeah, totally. So the IRA was a legislative package passed by the Democrats as their main legislative reconciliation effort under the Biden administration, that paired basically two different types of policy together. It included a large number of tax credits and incentives for private companies, as well as nonprofits and governments, to build zero carbon energy infrastructure, the kind of infrastructure that we'll need to build in order to decarbonize the grid, and then also kinds of infrastructure that we'll need to go beyond decarbonizing the grid too and decarbonize, say, the vehicle fleet. So these are the tax credits that have been discussed to help build solar and wind, that help build nuclear plants, that help make hydrogen, although we can talk about what happened to that, that paid consumers not only to buy a new electric vehicle, but to lease an electric vehicle, and also that then paid consumers to buy a used electric vehicle if they couldn't afford a new EV. So that was one set of policies in the IRA. And the second set of policies in the IRA were a set of grant and kind of economic development programs, policies that were directly overseen by the Department of Energy to directly seed some projects, economic development and clean energy projects across the country, and to directly say, here are hubs of, you know, the new green economy that we can kind of start with discrete projects across the country. And I would add another thing that happened in the IRA was that the Loan Programs Office, which is the in-house bank at the Department of Energy, which is meant to kind of make loans or extend financial credit to companies, to local governments, in ways that bring down the borrowing costs and bring down the financing costs of building huge pieces of low carbon infrastructure, whether that is new nuclear plants or a big solar farm or a big battery installation or a new EV factory. The Loan Programs Office saw its ability to make loans really significantly increase.
And just give me a sense of like how big the IRA was in terms of like, I mean, how much money are we spending here?
So there's $100 billion for energy and development programs kind of across the country. These were like direct spending authorized for DOD and EPA to spend. And then there was another kind of $683 billion, $650 billion in estimated tax credit outlays. One of the things about the IRA, now that we're in a post-One Big Beautiful Bill world, is that we actually don't know. At least I do not know as of recording this. And at Heatmap, we are not clear on how much money this law ultimately spent.
Yeah.
And that's because some spending was authorized by the Department of Energy or the EPA going into the Trump administration and has since been canceled. But then all those contracts kind of got fought over on a piece-by-piece basis. And so it's not clear how much money got out the door. And also, there's been some of those tax credits have been pulled back by the One Big Beautiful Bill. And so, specifically around wind and solar and around EVs. And so, we actually don't have a final estimate of how much money was spent by the IRA. But it was about $750 billion. But if you thought, for instance, that pickup on those tax credits could be way higher than CBO thought, then you'd say it was actually closer to a trillion or a trillion and a half. If you think it was not as... After the law passed, there were some entities that said, some investment banks that said, actually companies are going to use these tax credits way more than the Congressional Budget Office estimated. And then the direct cost of the bill went up to $1 trillion, $1.5 trillion. But we don't know yet ultimately what the bill totally cost, in part because some of these tax credits are still ongoing.
So there was a political theory of the IRA, which I'm not sure how to think about it now, but the political theory is that, you know, it passes on partisan lines. Not a single Republican votes for it in either Senate or the House. It is a party line bill that gets and is signed by Joe Biden, also a Democrat. And but the theory was that if you were to create investments in Republican areas, so where these solar farms were going to get built, where are these wind farms, when are these nuclear projects, where people were going to buy EVs, whatever it is. Like, these places were going to also be, honestly, concentrated in Republican areas because it's easier to build in those places. But just in general, there were going to be investments, green investments of factories, things that would create actual jobs or bring tax benefits to local areas. And as a result, even though Republicans didn't vote for it on the outset, it was going to create a political constituency within the Republican Party that would defend against attempts to repeal the IRA if a Republican were to be elected as president or they were to take over the Senate and the House. And I think in many ways, and correct me if I'm wrong, this was influenced by the experience of the Obama administration where disclosure in 2012, I think, the summer of, I was a fellow at the Climate Action Campaign trying to make the Clean Power Plan under the Obama administration more politically friendly, doing a very small job. The theory was then that they were trying to regulate point source pollution on coal plants at the executive level because they couldn't get climate policy passed through Congress. But of course, when Trump gets elected in 2016, that just gets immediately repealed by the EPA head under Trump. And so Democrats realizing this problem were like, okay, how do we create the situation where everything we do isn't undermined by the fact that Republicans will, of course, one day be in office again and can repeal everything that we're doing? And this was their theory. Like, we're going to do the IRA. There's going to be solar farms in Republican areas. There's going to be tax benefits, everything happening in Republican areas as well. And they won't let this happen. How has that played out for us here?
So I would say a few things. So first of all, I would say that the Democratic theory on this was heavily influenced by what they had just seen happen with the Affordable Care Act, in that they had seen the first Trump administration come into office promising to repeal the ACA and then basically discovering you couldn't do it because it was too popular, because the benefits were too diffuse, or because the benefits, once they were threatened, were popular enough that voters would step up, and then Republicans didn't feel like they could take that hard vote to repeal. Now,
the famous John McCain.
That being said, the real reason the ACA didn't get repealed was because of John McCain. And not because there was, like, House Republicans were like, well, we really can't do this. Like, ultimately, they did get really close to repealing core parts of the ACA. And so...
Let's pause there. Why was there a misreading of that? Is that like wishful thinking?
I think that there was a broad takeaway from that experience that a sufficiently popular policy would not be repealed by a Republican legislature.
Gotcha.
And I think you saw this most strongly, not actually in anything that became the IRA, but in the wrangling among Democrats that preceded the IRA back when it was called Build Back Better, where Democrats had a lot of ideas for social programs that they wanted to pass in the bill, most, I think, famously, the child care tax credit. But they didn't have the budgetary space to fund them for the full 10-year budget period. And so the way the Democrats kind of came up with, and there were a lot of intra-coalitional disagreements about how exactly these various social programs should get prioritized, right? And the way that Democrats kind of reconciled these social, these intra-coalitional disagreements was to say, well, we actually only need to extend these programs out 2 or 3 years because these programs are going to be so popular that actually nobody is going to repeal them. And future Congresses are going to just vote to continue these programs because they're not going to want to bear the political pain for letting them lapse. I think this was a deficient political theory for several reasons, in part that I think a Republican House or a Republican Senate under a Democratic president would have been more than happy to see those programs lapse under the theory that a Democratic president would have then had to own the political pain for their demise. But it was also deficient because Joe Manchin, who was the swing vote in the Senate, didn't agree to the theory and thought that this was ultimately a way to pass kind of under cover of night these much larger social programs than were actually in the budget. So
he was right.
He was right. I mean, I think like he was correct that that's exactly what the Democratic Party was trying to do. But
they just thought that was a good thing.
They just thought it was a good thing. And far be it from me to say whether it was a good or bad thing. But but I think that idea that future Congresses and future legislatures will not repeal a popular program became quite embedded in Democratic thinking about how these bills would work. I want to interrogate the... Oh, boy. I'm becoming an academic.
Interrogate away.
I want to push back or kind of reframe some of the political theory on the IRA that you're saying, because I think you're right. But I think what partially happened with the IRA was that there was actually a conflicting I think what happened with the IRA is that there was kind of an overlapping set of political arguments and political justifications for what became the IRA, many of which have now been disproven by events and many of which we need to kind of talk about. The first, and the one that precedes a Biden presidency, is that is an argument that came from the party's left. And that is that young voters would reward Democrats or return to Democrats or believe in the Democratic Party more if the Democratic Party prioritized climate change. This is something, and while this argument was not always made completely explicitly. It was implicit in this idea that, say, I mean, if you remember on the first day of the orientation for the new Democratic Congress in, on the early 2019.
No, I don't remember. Who remembers? Maybe you.
I remember.
None of our listeners remember that.
Well, basically, you come out of the 2018 midterms. Mm-hmm. Representative Ocasio-Cortez has just won, right? Mm-hmm. And the new Democrats are showing up on the Hill. This is kind of the first big day of Democrats in governance since the Trump administration has begun. And the Sunrise Movement, a basically unknown activist organization, holds a sit-in in Nancy Pelosi's office, mm-hmm. then Speaker Nancy Pelosi, or then soon to be House Speaker again, Nancy Pelosi's office, saying, we need a Green New Deal, and Democrats aren't taking climate change seriously enough. And implicit in that argument is that if Democrats do take climate change seriously, then young voters will, like, trust the party again and trust the party's establishment again. So that's one theory. This idea.
I wish I had a blaring button for, like, well, that one didn't pan out.
Yeah, that one didn't pan out at all. Well, I think it's worth, like,
yeah.
And then we see that idea kind of then continue through Democratic, the Democratic presidential primary and the general election, where infamously, Beto O'Rourke puts out during the primary a $5 trillion climate bill.
That's crazy.
Which is, to be clear, 5x what eventually did pass.
I just also want to say, like, we're about to, like, have a moment where, like, trillionaire becomes a new billionaire because, like, Elon Musk is on the threshold to become a trillionaire or whatever. But I'm just like, $1 trillion. I mean, I want to put this into context for people, but I'm trying to struggling for being able to how to do it. how much what we spend on American military budget? I think this is, like, probably the easiest way to do it. So we spent less than $1 billion in 2024 on the American military.
Really?
In the American military budget. Yeah. Sorry. We spent $997 billion.
Okay. I was going to say.
You're,
I
like,
think we did.
There's no way that's true.
I was like, that's not true.
Like, fact check. No. We spent almost $1 trillion on the entire American military budget in 2024. Like, that is the level of spending we're talking about for, like, times five for a climate measure.
Well, that's right. And also, and to be clear that this was spending that was going to be parceled out over a decade or so.
Yeah.
But look, the U.S. is a $30 trillion economy, right? Like, the
$5 trillion
is a huge amount of money. And the Sunrise Movement said that's not enough, said this is not a serious climate plan. And it's not a serious climate plan because Beto O'Rourke took fossil fuel money.
Yeah.
They gave him a failing grade. And so there was, that's one theory, right, of climate politics.
If only he said six.
Going into the bus. If only he had said six.
Then Sunrise.
I mean,
I'm traumatizing you now.
Yes. Yes, you're traumatizing
just
me,
like,
now.
I see people who are listening to this can't see the vacant look in Rob's eyes.
I'm just remembering the 2020 primary.
Yeah.
Well, because you'd get things like, you know, you'd see the Sunrise Movement, which ultimately endorsed Bernie, reject other plans, like, too, you see people aligned with them kind of reject other plans as too car centric, you know, not leaning enough into kind of transit oriented growth or degrowth. And then you'd look at the Bernie plan, it'd be like $2 trillion so that every American can get a new EV.
Yeah.
It's like, what the hell are we doing here? So,
but, like, okay, so I want to step back here because I think
That's one theory.
That theory,
and then,
clearly doesn't pan out, also, just because after the IRA, which is, again, the biggest climate bill of our lifetimes, we see actual reductions in youth interest in the Democratic Party.
Correct.
So to me,
And Biden ultimately feels like he ultimately approves a discrete number of fossil fuel projects.
Yeah.
And it kind of famously, this one project in Alaska that he felt like he didn't have a legal way not to approve of.
Yeah.
That project would have contributed to global emissions, depending on some estimates, about 1% of the emissions reductions that would have come from the IRA.
Mm-hmm.
And yet.
And I just want to, like, preempt here, because I think a lot of people who are maybe much more militant on this issue might say, well, like, Yeah, I mean, there's a threshold thing. Like, if you're talking about appealing to feminists and you say, we're going to let you vote, like, that's, like, the baseline level of interest that you can get for feminists to vote for you. But I do think that, like, I just want to, like, hammer home here, like, I think that this is actually an insufficient and, like, a very counterproductive way to think about politics. You have one party that passes the biggest climate bill of your lifetimes and the other that's, like, I am literally going to destroy all of that. And so to me, it's like when I hear like, well, you're not going to win the youth over with your milquetoast IRA. I'm just like, you are not living in reality about the way that climate politics or policy was ever going to function in this country. And so even that, even if it was true that it would take 10x what the IRA does, that is so politically impossible that you are just saying there's not worth trying to get your vote.
Well, and there was a specific argument that was kind of marshaled in response to any expansion of fossil fuel infrastructure under the Biden administration from any Democrat kind of during that period, which was that there's a single line from there's one of the findings basically of the International Energy Agency's reports on how to achieve 1.5C of warming, which was going to be very difficult to achieve, is that basically is that existing fossil fuel supply would be enough to kind of meet demand in a 1.5C world, and that there didn't need to be big new oil fields, for instance. This kind of becomes in the discourse a line that any investment in fossil fuels from anywhere is inconsistent with a 1.5C world, which might be true, but what was not being asked was, is a 1.5C world consistent with like attainable outcomes in American politics? And the issue was that Biden was kind of being judged, and the issue of many, many issues, obviously. I think the president's inability to talk or kind of defend himself at length turned out to be quite significant here. And maybe a different candidate could have kind of done something, you know, to some degree,
you
like the whole Biden experiment.
You have to go to the bully pulpit in order for the bully pulpit to work.
Yes, you can't. Yeah, exactly. Like, as with so much about the Biden administration, it's such a poor
test
of so many ideas here, because the president ultimately was like unable to communicate like complex ideas to the electorate at length, respond.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that has to be said.
So there's that theory.
Yeah.
Okay. Then there's a theory that then the IRA gets passed, and then a lot of the projects go to red states, and then the theory is, okay, well, look, as you were saying, sure, these projects are going to go to red states. But that means that this spending is going to be really way more durable than it would be if, say, we were putting these projects in like the Rust Belt, you know. Now, part of the reason those projects go to the Sun Belt or red states is because red states tend to have local economic development offices. They tend to be quite aggressive about getting
they're pro-business.
But not only the pro-business, I actually think this is kind of one of the interesting parts of the IRA story that get lost. They have state offices that are pro-business. They have state offices that are trying to make it easier for large industrial projects to come to those states.
Yeah.
Now, sometimes at a cost to local environmental quality. But those states have a very kind of clear theory about how they're going to grow, and they have state government offices that go out and try to get mineral refining projects, or go out and try to get battery assembly projects, go out and try to get EV assembly projects. And that means that actually those states partially get, we think of it as, oh, well, of course, more projects went to red states because they have more business-friendly regulations. And they do. But often it's also because they have state offices of economic development that are really aggressive about
and
going
out and
getting those projects.
And those things are interlocking.
They're interlocking, yeah. Yes. But I think it's interesting to think of this as a state capacity story in addition to being a kind of deregulatory story.
But that theory,
yes,
I feel like, doesn't pan out.
No, it doesn't pan out
but
at
like,
all. Yeah.
Walk me. Oh, well, and I guess I want to actually stop on one thing you said, which is that this theory kind of comes out once people realize these projects are going into red states. So do you not think this was like a pre-existing theory, and that it kind of was like tacked on after we saw a lot of that development go there? Because I think in many ways, a lot of Democrats were sort of embarrassed about the fact that there weren't a lot of projects being built in the Californias, the Minnesotas, et cetera, like all of the blue states where you might expect to see economic development.
First, I would say blue states did see some projects from here. But the issue is that the existing kind of most modern aspects of the EV supply chain,
mm-hmm.
and the automotive supply chain are in the South. And so when you're looking at expanding or transforming that supply chain, it's easiest to then just keep sticking more assets in the South. Those are also right to work states, right? So,
mm-hmm.
Which is a complicated and contributing factor to where companies obviously make investment decisions. That's partially a post hoc justification for how this all pans out. But it's also that, like, look, policymakers are torn between trying to place the projects that they do have some kind of decision making power,
mm-hmm.
where they go in favorable places, but they also are kind of at the mercy of where projects apply to them, right?
Yeah.
We don't have a centrally planned economy. You can't decide where the next Rivian factory is going to get built. If Rivian wants to build its next factory in Georgia, like,
that's where it's going.
You can't.
Yeah.
There's no decision-making apparatus.
But I think that this theory, again, like, it's hard because it's a counterfactual. Maybe this is still the best theory. Like, in order to build climate, a climate constituency in certain parts of the Republican Party, you do need to have these kind of investments in red states. Maybe it's a necessary prerequisite. It could still be true. But I hope you can talk us through, like, what's happened to the IRA under the Trump administration and what's happened to clean energy projects. And you've hinted a little bit about this, about some of these contracts being rescinded. And of course, like, the permitting of renewable energy has been attacked by the current administration. And so to me, it's like, I think it kind of failed if you were going to.
I think basically all these theories fail, right?
Yeah,
So the idea that young people will flock to Democrats when Democrats start taking climate change seriously, that fails. It fails in public polling. And when we see young people trend away from Democrats in 2024. Democrats made, and the Biden administration made, environmental justice central to how it implemented many of these policies. It had this idea of Justice 40, that 40% of the money had to go to environmental justice communities, which kind of included both, communities of color that are on the fence line, mm-hmm. of existing large-scale energy projects. It includes kind of underinvested inner cities, and it also includes areas that saw major fossil fuel investment and are now no longer see that investment, like West Virginia. All of those communities trend away from Democrats, mm-hmm. in the 2024 election. And then President Trump comes in and pass it, and the One Big Beautiful Bill Act goes through reconciliation mm-hmm. process. And what we see is that all these communities with all these legislators with projects in their backyard, you know, red state Republican legislators with EV projects in their backyard, with solar projects in their backyard that are dependent on renewables or dependent on clean energy to kind of supply future demand, also just vote to gut parts of the IRA. So what the One Big Beautiful Bill Act did,
mm-hmm.
Which I continue to insist on calling it by its, you know, Christian name,
must.
is that is interesting. And I want to say is in some ways more interesting than a mm-hmm. simple the IRA got repealed frame mm-hmm. would tell us. So the big thing it did was it tore out all the EV policy, any kind of consumer or business side, demand side policy to encourage people or companies to buy EVs.
That's electric all. Vehicles are remarkably unpopular in a way that I did not expect.
They're shockingly unpopular.
Yeah, yeah.
People don't like being told what car to buy.
Yeah.
And they really don't like being told what car to buy by Democrats.
Yeah.
That all gets torn out. Despite the existence of, say, EV factories mm-hmm. in Kentucky, in Georgia, in Texas,
mm-hmm.
you know, that doesn't really change how those senators think about the doesn't seem to change how those senators or how those representatives think about
and
the policy.
And those voters. Yeah.
Right. And in fact, one thing that was quite clear even before OBA happened, even before the 2024 election, mm-hmm. was that you could go talk to people in those places and they weren't like thrilled about the investment they were getting.
Yeah.
And now maybe that's because it took too long for those factories to get built. And once those factories were built, then they were going to understand how these,
mm-hmm.
you know, factories in their communities were driving economic growth, but it didn't happen.
Yeah.
Republicans go in and they remove solar and wind from the IRA. So the IRA does a kind of interesting piece of energy policy. For a long time, for decades, Congress had basically encouraged different types of energy development through the tax code by naming specific technologies.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to build geothermal, you want to build solar, you want to build wind, Congress would write different technologies into the law.
Mm-hmm.
And then some qualified for the production tax credit, which like pays companies for every kilowatt hour of energy they sell to the grid. Some qualified for the investment tax credit, which like covers 30% of the cost of a project or sometimes more. Congress went in the IRA and did something quite interesting, and it was led by Ron Wyden. And he said, look, we're tired of only giving certain discounts to certain technologies when there's a new technology, having to write in like mm-hmm. what the technology that benefits is going to be. And so we're just going to say, if you generate electricity in a relatively zero carbon way, mm-hmm. a relatively low carbon way, you know, equivalent roughly to solar or wind,
mm-hmm.
then we are going to cover, we're either going to pay you on a kilowatt hour basis, or we're going to cover 30% of the cost of your project. This is the so-called technology neutral approach.
Mm-hmm.
What Republicans do in response, which I actually think is kind of interesting, is that they go in and they say, we're actually going to leave that entire policy in place.
Mm-hmm.
What we don't like about renewables is that they are intermittent, that solar only generates electricity during the day, and that wind generates electricity at kind of more predictable times that aren't quite during the day. Sometimes
yeah.
it's overnight, sometimes it's in the afternoon, but it doesn't generate electricity all the time. You can't count.
You can't turn it on.
You can't turn
yeah.
it on
yeah.
in the same way you can turn on a gas plant
yeah.
or a nuclear plant. They go, so we're going to write those out.
Mm.
We're going to write explicitly say this tax credit won't apply to solar and wind anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want to build a battery and you want to save that energy that you've generated on solar and wind, that actually still qualifies. So what they do is they say, we're going to leave the entire tech neutral tax credit in place, but we're just going to write out solar and wind, starting for projects that don't break ground basically by next year. So that's another thing they do. I think there are places in OBA where you can see the vindication of the political theory of mm-hmm. the IRA. So the Trump administration has been quite aggressive in killing carbon capture projects
mm-hmm.
and direct air capture projects.
Yeah.
And this is quite interesting in the politics of climate change, because the Biden administration has been really solicitous of those projects. And then there had been...
And they were like in red state. They're Louisiana and Texas.
Louisiana,
they're
in Gulf State.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And there had been pushback from the environmental left
mm-hmm.
that said, these projects, either projects that capture... You know, projects that capture CO2 at a power plant or mm-hmm. at an industrial site are just extending the life of the fossil fuel economy. They're just big subsidies to mm-hmm. fossil fuel companies. And these projects that capture CO2 directly from the air are like never going to be at scale to the extent that we need. And so they pushed back against these carbon capture or direct air capture projects and basically said these are giveaways to fossil fuel companies.
Yeah.
The Trump administration comes in and is like, we actually don't like these projects either.
Yeah.
But we don't like these projects not because they're giveaway to fossil fuel companies, but because we don't like the idea that there's anything wrong with carbon in
yeah.
the first place. We think carbon's great.
Why are you sucking it out
Why
of the air?
Why are you sucking it out of the air? We like carbon. Like, we don't want to identify that there's any problem here. And
yeah.
so the Department of Energy under Secretary Chris Wright
mm-hmm.
has been really aggressive in killing those projects and cutting off funding to
mm-hmm.
those projects. What's interesting is that OBA preserves the tax credit for capturing CO2 removing CO2 from the air. Now, it makes it way more economically beneficial to then use that captured CO2 to go drill for more oil.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the change that the One Big Beautiful Bill Act makes to the tax credit to support carbon capture. And that's not good for the climate.
Yeah.
But why I think that's interesting is because the Trump administration, if left to its own devices, I think would have repealed this tax credit 45Q. And I do think, and I have heard, that there was pushback from oil companies and there was pushback from places with those projects that were like, no, actually, we are going to need, don't kill that. We value
so
that tax credit.
What, so can you say like which places were like was it Louisiana and Texas they wanted their DAC plants?
Ultimately, this is not something that like came out in, this is not like, you can't see it in the legislative math because
yeah.
it never entered the bill text.
Yeah.
But basically, in discussions around the bill, what I've heard is like that the oil companies went and fought for those tax credits. So I think that is one place where, interestingly,
oil companies, the saviors of the IRA.
That's not what I said at all. That's not what I said in any way. But
we'll
I think it's an interesting place where corporates did move to protect some of the policies in the
mm-hmm.
IRA in a way that is like sort of in line with
mm-hmm.
what maybe one of the theorized political theories behind the IRA was.
Yeah. So we're used to, and we just spent the bulk of this episode talking about the politics of climate on the left. But I also think, I mean, in some ways, the theory that we just ran through around how do you create a constituency that is pro-climate on the right, if an alien were to, like, drop down into the United States and not was not allowed to talk to anyone but had access to, like, maybe all of, like, the, you know, statistics about where renewable energy existed in the country and, like, what statistics...
And where it's easy to build where renewable it's easy. Energy. Yeah,
yeah.
Totally.
And you were, like, and they were just to observe, like, these, like, basic facts, and they would go, like, okay, like, utility-scale solar, biggest place where that is? Texas.
Yeah.
Wind, utility-scale wind, where do you see that? Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, you know, what is it? Iowa. Big, windy states,
yeah,
famously.
Totally.
And you would not come away with the perception that... You need to really fight to build a political constituency for climate change on the right in the context of where can you build renewable energy.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've just been trying to step back here because I think that, like, sometimes, like, people get stuck in certain, like, politically, like, you go start going down a certain path and then all of a sudden you're like, let's just reevaluate the whole situation here.
Yeah.
Like, what are we even trying to do when we're talking about climate policy in the domestic American context? And so... Seems like genuinely unclear to me at this point. Like, do we need a constituency that's pro-climate on the right? Or do you need a political constituency that's pro-climate on the left? Because it's quite difficult to build renewable energy in Democratic states, even though they're nominally more pro-climate in their rhetoric. They'll pass more of these resolutions in local city halls. They'll ban different kinds of things I think have to do with much more like keeping the local environment clean, like wanting to maintain that kind of pristine kind of green energy, green kind of nature, which is like not
yeah.
important, but it's just like that is different than like reducing carbon emissions
totally
in the world. And so how do you think about this problem?
Well, I mean, I guess I would first echo your observation that it's very hard to build renewable energy in blue states.
Yeah.
And, you know, at Heatmap, we have a service called Heatmap Pro that tracks county level restrictions on renewable construction. And what we found is like the easiest places to build in brief are kind of the Southeast, Texas, mm-hmm. and the middle of the country. And the hardest places to build are yes, blue states and kind of the Northeast. Where it's really hard to build, kind of interestingly, is like where let's say the some of the legacy political commitments of blue states meet new Trump constituencies.
Mm.
Ohio, Indiana. It's a nightmare to build in Indiana.
Yeah.
That's like it's the upper Midwest states. And indeed the number one political predictor of which counties will have restricted renewable construction is not how Republican are they. It is actually how much did they swing from Obama in 2008 to Trump in 2016.
It's what do you think Obama, that's measuring? Because I think that's measuring people who are exposed to climate policies hurting their financial interests, whether real or perceived. Because swinging from Obama to Trump, a lot of those are people who felt that climate, which became the big part of Obama's second term, was part and parcel of a ideology that was shifting against the economic interests of the white middle class and towards we need to care about people outside this country, we need to care about like developing nations, climate goals, etc. And like this is something I've been noodling over. I don't know, like, what do you think that Obama-Trump swing is capturing?
I think what it's capturing is more or less what you said. I mean, I think the issue here is what it's capturing is exactly what it's capturing. But I think if we were to kind of talk in a more aesthetic, sociological way, it's capturing a group of people who are probably in the white working or middle class who feel that the Democratic Party has been now represents the interests of a more urban kind of cosmopolitan professional class of people who are not directly exposed to issues of energy production and are somewhat insulated from energy costs or large-scale kind of industrial work. And I think in that sense, climate may also be functioning as much more of an aesthetic issue
mm-hmm.
than a literal one. However, I also think that renewables are a very land-intensive source of energy.
Yeah.
Solar, the more electricity you want to generate from solar, the more land it's going to take up.
Mm-hmm.
wind is not as land intensive, but it is does have wide scale impacts in terms of where you can see the turbines. Yes, exactly. And it is in fact the case that those projects do get built in the parts of the country where there's not a lot of other stuff economically going on. Mm-hmm. And then they use up land that could go to another use. And renewables are really not a very labor-intensive source of they're not a very labor-intensive form of economic development. Yeah. And so
they don't require continual maintenance by a ton of people. So like all of the jobs are like upfront in the construction part, and then it requires a few people to kind of like maintain it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And like they are kind of financial assets that like sit there, generate electricity. They don't
but
have
a lot of... But
you
could tax them.
You could tax them. Yeah. And they do generate like...
Tons of local revenue. Yeah.
They can generate local revenue. Yeah, exactly.
But, or like some farmers are able to lease some of their land that's unproductive for agricultural use in order to like lease it for energy projects. And like there are ways in which it can be, but I agree. From the jobs perspective, it doesn't really make sense for...
Well, and one thing we're seeing at Heatmap now is that like the same people who oppose renewables also oppose data centers.
Yeah.
Because they go, they look at these things as two sides of the same coin. They are economic. They are forms of not very labor intensive economic development that get built in places where they don't generate a lot of jobs. Maybe they toss off some public revenue, although, you know, depending on what the state tax code is like, sometimes there's tax breaks for data centers.
Yeah.
Data centers kind of then tax the local electricity grid or use more local electricity. They kind of see them as almost like economic outposts of
urban America.
Exactly. I think over the past few years, we've kind of rediscovered the old wisdom of a lot of things that used to be said about climate policy and then weren't said anymore.
Yeah. Like what?
That climate policy and doing and addressing climate change is really hard in a democracy because really hard generally because it imposes near-term costs for a long-term benefit.
Yeah.
That's one. The second would be that people do care about climate change a little bit, but they don't really want to pay very much to solve it. That's two. It's not really going to be a main focus in people's, like, it's just not why people come to politics. And it's a very challenging issue because it's a global problem. Mm-hmm. And so I learned, I live in New York, right? And I watched the Mamdani campaign kind of go from being this long shot primary campaign to being, to winning, right? And now Zoran Mamdani, interesting figure because he was central to the environmental left. He describes himself in 2021 as like a proud eco-socialist. He fights for very aggressive climate bills in the New York State Legislature, many of which pass. He talks about climate change. He makes it central to his, you know, early political career. First of all, and we can maybe stick this in the show notes, if there are show notes, he did not talk about climate change at all during the campaign.
We'll put your article about this in the show notes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And we track this. And basically, he does not really give an interview about climate change at all after Earth Day in April.
It's a good marker.
Yeah, exactly. And even in that interview, it's with The Nation. The plan he's rolling out is not some big plan that we're going to like coat New York City in renewables. It's like we're going to turn 500 schools into being like nice climate, like climate friendly schools. And we're going to take the like blacktops that they have in the back and we're going to like turn them into green spaces. Mm-hmm. And we're going to like turn, you know, a couple dozen schools into like climate adaptation zones. But he's not like proposing.
Okay. I just want to make a one asterisk here, which is just that like one of my biggest pet peeves when people talk about climate policy is how much we've normalized talking about local beautification projects as like part of like an emissions structure strategy. Like that's fine. People like parks. Yeah. It's good to have parks. But I just think in general, like if you care about climate and you're spending your time at City Hall trying to like make your like local community either more green or whatever, it's like you are like fooling yourself that is having some like massive impact.
But I think that this is actually the challenge of climate change as an issue is that most people want. Yes. People care about their local environment.
Yes.
They care about the place they live. They want the place they live to be beautiful.
Yeah.
And they want to have a high quality of life in that place.
Yes.
And actual climate policy often, actual decarbonization policy often runs
counter to that.
Counter to that.
And I mean, it seems to me like the genius and the like tragedy of the environmental movement is that it took constituencies that were frustrated by the costs of development in their community, that in the 1970s in particular were like finally sick of all of the growth that had happened, whether it's housing development or energy development, or the fact that companies and corporations were creating all these problems with consumer products and there were rivers on fire, and they were like, they harnessed that anger and tried to turn it into a broader movement that would focus on decarbonization and larger problems of the climate. And that works in some extent when there's like synergies, and there are some synergies, like it is true, like if you plant more trees, like that is like good for carbon reduction. But it's actually like makes it quite difficult to push this coalition to support you in putting a bunch of EV plants in their backyard, because they're like, hey, that's the thing we said was anti-environmental. And I'm sure you find this in your reporting all the time, but like I'll find all the time, especially environmentalists that are in their 60s or 70s, who are like confused by my questions about how they are opposing renewable energy, transit-oriented development. I'm like, why are you opposing this if you're pro-climate? And they're like, to be pro-climate is to oppose this.
I went to Greenland a few years ago with a bunch of climate researchers, and yeah. It was kind of old. One older climate researcher, great guy, who I won't name to protect the innocent, and and then his younger set of doctoral students, yeah. Right? And I knew one of the doctoral students. I went, and they were studying basically kind of the historic climate of Greenland.
Mm-hmm.
And on this trip, an argument breaks out between the younger doctoral students and the older doctoral students that mm-hmm. I'm kind of participating in, where, and it's about nuclear energy. And the younger, the PhD student says to the older climate scientist, like, but you care about climate.
Yeah.
So like, why, nuclear energy is zero emissions. So like, why do you oppose nuclear
mm-hmm.
when you also have devoted your professional life to alerting people to how bad, you know, carbon emissions are, to the risks of climate change? And he was like, you know, climate change is a big problem and we're going to have to like deal with it. But the worst thing that exists is nuclear waste. The worst thing that can happen is when a nuclear plant melts down. And so we should not get into that. Like we're going to deal with this climate change problem. But the worst thing that could happen is that you build a nuclear plant.
So even, I mean, this is across the world, the environmental movement has been built on the backs of the anti-nuclear movement.
Yeah, exactly.
The original NIMBYs, in many cases, are anti-nuclear activists.
And anti-highway.
Anti-highway, right. For sure. But I think that actually gets me solid.
And like even during the early Clinton administration, mm-hmm. when you see policies that are now kind of discussed historically in retrospect, as like the BTU tax is I have been guilty of this. So the BTU tax was a proposed tax early in the Clinton administration that was going to be a tax on certain forms of energy production. It was very unpopular and it wound up getting knocked out of the budget. It is discussed in retrospect, and I've been guilty of this, as a kind of carbon price that the mm-hmm. Clinton administration tried to bring as part of its like budget balancing early 90s politics. And it would have functioned sort of as a carbon price in that it would have been very pro-renewable development.
Mm-hmm.
But what it was actually worst for were coal plants and nuclear plants, which generate high amounts of heat in the generating facility. And so early climate policy is like anti-nuclear as well as being pro-renewable.
Yeah.
And I think one thing that's happening now, though, is that as renewables move from being a kind of hypothetical technology, mm-hmm. a technology that like it's nice when they go on people's roofs, or that you kind of imagine what it would be like to have, you know, the land generating free electricity from the sun or from the wind, to being an actual industrial reality across large swaths of the country and an actual energy technology with its own constituency and with an ability to generate, you know, gigawatt hours of electricity. But that brings its own trade-offs, because any form of energy production has its own trade-offs. I think what we're seeing is like people realizing like, oh, these are actually like turn large swaths of land into like passive, quiet industrial sites, but industrial sites nonetheless.
Yes.
And I like solar and wind. I'm pro solar and wind. I think it was a bad, you know, like, but like nonetheless, what we're discovering is that a lot of people who thought they were pro-solar and wind and who like the idea of solar and wind somewhere.
Or on their rooftop.
On their rooftop.
Yeah.
Don't like it when it actually... When
it becomes an industrial use.
When it becomes an industrial use and when we're talking about generating the amount of electricity that we need to actually decarbonize the economy.
And I think that this actually segues perfectly into... I had a recent conversation with Bill McKibben on the show, climate activist, founder of 350.org.
And initial climate journalist. He writes the key foundational text for early climate journalism.
I mean, he's doing it all. Activist, climate, kind of policymaker, journalist, et cetera. He recently wrote a book where... it's called Here Comes the Sun. And the idea of this book is that solar is the future. That for climate activists, but also just like for people who want cheap energy, the costs of building solar energy have come down significantly. And we have this one exchange that I'm like curious about your take on, because when I was on a train in Germany and I saw the solar field next to me, I was like, that looks cool as hell. Like,
yeah, exactly. When I see a wind farm, I'm like, oh, that's
awesome.
Sick.
Yeah,
that's so cool. They're moving. Those turbines move slowly. It looks like the future. Like, this is awesome.
Like, when I was in Hawaii, I saw them on a mountain. And I was like, oh, that's so cool. And then, like, someone else was like, that's not cool. Like, okay, that shit. I was like, all right, sorry. I'm not just having a vacation. So I have been traumatized by the land use wars, mostly in housing, which is my focus, but also in energy and transit. And I just think that we need to, like, there are fights we're going to have on land use all the time when it comes to building new housing, because you have to house people somewhere. It's physical structures. When it comes to particularly transmission, which those lines have to cross dozens, if not hundreds of jurisdictions in order to get energy from the places where it is produced to the places that where people need it. Like, you just have to build those things across lots of places. And then, like, to me, like, we should try to minimize as many of these fights as possible, because it just takes too long to, like, work through them, and also just to be more democratically responsive to people who are clearly upset about it.
Yeah.
And that's really pushed me towards types of clean energy that are really low land intensive, like nuclear, like hopefully geothermal, and hopefully other future technologies that also pan out in this way. And, you know, McKibben was like not super jazzed about this thesis. So I don't know. What do you think?
So early in Heatmap's life, we did a piece of polling. Now that, look, I would say these prompts are like not the world's most battle-tested prompts.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it is revealing nonetheless that we asked 1,000 American adults, which of the following statements do you agree with most?
Okay.
We said, first statement, we should roll out renewable energy slowly to ensure natural land or wild animals aren't harmed, even if it means taking longer to reduce greenhouse gas producing emissions. Second, we should roll out renewable energy quickly to lower emissions as fast as possible, even if it means harming natural land or wild animals.
Mm-hmm.
The first statement, we should go slowly on renewables, 79% support. The second statement, we should roll out renewables fast because we need to decarbonize quickly, 21% support.
Yeah, well, not popular.
It is not popular.
Not popular.
It's not popular saying we have to build renewables really fast to decarbonize. Yeah. And it's not popular a lot of places it's not popular to build renewables at all.
Yeah.
And so I try to remain a little coy about this because I'm not a policymaker.
Mm-hmm.
What I would say is that for me, the takeaway from this poll and the takeaway from watching the Biden administration and the takeaway from seeing what's happened under the Trump administration is that, you know what? Do you know what nuclear plants do? Not only do they use a relatively small energy, small physical footprint to generate electricity, they also are often surrounded by parkland because nobody wants to live near one. And so if you want an energy technology that maximizes the amount of like open wild space while minimizing the amount of like industrial footprint on the land, nuclear is actually a fantastic option. What I would have said a few years ago is like, that being said, it's really expensive to build and we haven't found a way to do it yet.
That's true. Yes.
And every recent nuclear project we've built in the United States, all three of them this century, have gone way over budget and taken a long, long time.
Mm-hmm.
I think the Trump administration now is testing that thesis, and maybe, you know, it will find a way to speed up nuclear production in hopefully a, you know, safe way. And if so, that will be a fantastic development. And one thing we've seen from Democrats now as well is a recognition that the types of electricity production that nuclear can service to a grid, the fact that it's dispatchable, the fact that it provides power 24/7, mm-hmm. the fact that it's a very stable kind of asset on your grid that's generating all the time and is very dependable, that those services that a nuclear plant can provide are like of much higher value mm-hmm. than a marginal wind farm or a marginal solar farm especially. And so in New York, for instance, the governor has proposed building at least 1 gigawatt of new nuclear in New York, kind of partially at public expense, in order to both achieve the state's climate goals and also because she's like, we need more generation. It has to come from somewhere, and I don't want to build fossil fuels.
Yeah.
And so therefore, and because the New York Power Authority, the kind of quasi, the public power generating entity that basically only exists in New York as a state level agency, is already has 7 gigawatts of renewables in the pipeline. And so she's like, okay, well, we're going to max out renewables, I guess. And it's hard to build renewables in New York for mm-hmm. permitting reasons, for transmission reasons. But like, mm-hmm. we could add a lot more nuclear here. And so we should do that too.
Well, on the abundance, Kathy Hochul, last point, who has been a champion of a lot of abundance things recently. I could talk about this forever with you, Rob, but I think it's time for our last and final question, which is, what is an idea that you've come across recently that you thought was awful? Like, you know, an idea you came across recently that you were like, I want to argue against this. This is wrong. This is bad. This is misguided, whatever it is.
I have two.
Okay.
I have two.
Noted hater, Rob Meyer.
Noted hater. The first is going to be so much less controversial than the second one. The first one is actually something that I feel like is a sea change happening in the culture.
Okay.
That you're beginning to see around in response to things like Kelsey's education article.
Kelsey Piper, we'll link that in the show notes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Where basically all these UCSD students can't do math.
Yeah.
Now, right? Partially because the UCSD no longer considers...
The SAT.
The SAT or the ACT, right.
Thank but you. Also because they're not being allowed to fail in K-12. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
I feel like in recognition of the problems with this story, there's of course a large part given to kind of the role of COVID school closures and kind of the key educational development opportunity that these kids missed for reasons that may or may not have been avoidable. There's also, I feel like, people saying, you know, this is partially due to smartphones.
Mm-hmm.
This is partially due to like this set of people never being required to kind of log off and do concentrated work. And I feel like a broad sea change in the culture that I think is good is that, but I think was not popular for a while, is that I think social media really prioritizes and gives great credence to systemic arguments where people can blame kind of societal problem
mm-hmm.
on capitalism or on big companies or on big tech. And I think one positive change that's happened recently is that we're beginning to say, you know, not everything is the fault of systems around us. Mm-hmm. And we do actually need individuals to take some personal responsibility for their own decisions and say, you do actually need to develop the character not to be on your phone all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You do actually need to develop the character to resist social media and to understand that life is more than social media. And we should help people. We should, you know, make changes to systems such that people have those opportunities. But like, I think it is positive that we are moving away from a world where we say people actually do have, like, if you're laying in bed all the time watching TikToks or watching Instagram Reels or Facebook, God forbid the Facebook shorts. Those are the worst ones.
I've never seen a Facebook short.
Oh my gosh. They're like, talk about slop. That's kind of your fault. Like, you need to be more than that as an individual.
I wrote this piece for The Argument about killing my own TikTok addiction.
Yeah.
And there's a level to which, I mean, A, let's start researching kind of addictions and stuff. A lot of people quit really hard substances.
Mm-hmm.
People quit heroin like every single day.
Yeah.
People are quitting cocaine and like alcohol.
Yeah.
And like, I have friends who've gotten really dependent on marijuana who've like figured out a way to like quit that in their lives.
Yeah.
There's a level of like, weirdly with social media, because I think we often talk about it in the context of children, there's a level of like learned helplessness that's happened here.
Yes, exactly.
And I agree with you, I think that like obviously the fact that these social media companies have like perfected reinforcement learning algorithms that have like hacked our attention like a game, like that's true. And are you going to spend the rest of your life on your phone because that's true? Like, you know what I mean? Right, like, totally. Like, is that really how you're going to spend your like one beautiful life?
Yeah, exactly. Well, and so, also I think there was this, I think people kind of backed into it. Like if you had been, if you told, I think a lot of people who are now in Reels land as adults, and I'm talking about our cohort here because I think it's a little different.
Ours is a little weird because I'm so much younger than you. So ours a bit, you know, maybe your cohort.
I'm near death. Near death. I need the billionaire pills.
Yeah.
They're gonna keep me young. I think if you had told people, oh, you're just gonna spend, like if smartphones had been understood at their advent as everyone's going to carry around a little television all the time. Mm-hmm. And what they're gonna do with that television is watch, you know,
four hours
of TV a day. That's kind of a knockoff version of either cable news or like HGTV. You think that's going to be a good development?
Yeah.
Or the Home Shopping Network.
Yeah.
You think that's going to be a good development for people society? Yeah. I think the answer would be no. But because smartphones kind of happened to begin to penetrate in society when mobile internet was not good enough to get video, and you could only get text, they were kind of like a, like the internet was briefly a literary thing.
Yes.
And spending a lot of time on the internet was a, was kind of a literary and
well,
verbal
or
focused or porn, but like was a more verbal focus.
Yes. You couldn't load.
And polite society was seen as a more verbal and words focused development.
Yeah.
Its conversion into just being another form of TV has allowed video content to like Trojan horse itself into people's lives in a way that I don't think would have been true.
I think this was kind of controversial. What's your second one? What's even more controversial than this?
Okay. The second one is that I think that I have to be so careful here.
Oh.
Fossil fuel companies engaged in some terrible, terrible behavior in the 90s and aughts to downplay and to spread doubt about climate change.
Yeah.
I think that that is a historical fact, is unimpeachable.
Okay.
And I think that over the long term and at decadal scales, governments and companies are intervening in energy systems in a big way to keep those energy systems fossil dependent.
Mm-hmm.
Even some of what the Trump administration is doing now to slow down offshore wind development, or to basically destroy offshore wind development in the Northeast and to slow down wind and solar development across the country. That being said, I do not think climate change is a hard problem to solve primarily because of fossil fuel companies. And I think even if fossil fuel companies existed in a very different form, we would find it to still be a hard problem to solve. And that's because it's a hard technical problem to solve. And that's because it's a hard social problem to solve. And that's because, look, what we think of when we think of fossil fuel companies are Exxon, Chevron, Occidental, these big, global, often U.S. headquartered, publicly traded oil, mostly, you know, and gas and chemical companies. Those companies produce like 10 to 15% of the world's oil.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the world's oil is produced by government-owned, state-owned enterprises. And most of that oil is produced by actually state-owned enterprises owned by medium-sized companies, not even the Saudi Aramcos of the world, but like the Pemex, you know, in Mexico. And I think the exact kind of challenges that we're talking about now, oh, solar and wind are great. They produce cheap electricity. But it's hard to balance them across a grid without batteries.
Yeah.
Nuclear is great, but you need really, really high engineering standards in order for it to be safe, right? Which I think is something that even the most pro-nuclear person would say, right?
Yeah.
First of all, that's one thing I would say. The other thing I would say is that pre-1990, and especially pre-1980, you see people kind of floating journals or internal documents at Exxon, utilities, that show that these entities were aware that climate change was going to be a big problem and didn't do anything about it. And I just want to be clear that everyone knew climate change was coming, but it was so far away in the future that it did not, it was not a urgent concern.
I mean, the reason I think this is an important point, because I think that, like, it's controversial, but it's not just controversial for controversy's sake. It's like, when you get convinced that the only thing standing between you and utopia, success in your policy area, is a handful of people or a handful of groups or corporations that you can defeat, you will actually, A, like, miss the truth of what's very, very difficult about the world, so you're redirecting your energies in the wrong place. And B, I think you get very fatalistic about democracy, which is what gets me kind of concerned about this, because the actual problem and the thing that we've investigated in this podcast together is all of the reasons why a lot of people, even people who call themselves environmentalists, have been opposed to clean energy. And, like, as someone who is extremely excited about clean energy and wants it to exist, like, you have to reckon with that problem. You can't just go like, well, if, you know, if Shell didn't exist, we wouldn't have this problem. Why do they let Shell continue to exist? Why do you let them still give money? And I agree. This is still a very prevalent view that you're arguing against here.
It is. And I want to say that kind of, I want to be very delicate about how we talk about this, because I think it is true that, for instance, like, Donald Trump did sit down with oil company executives before he ran for office and is like, I'm going to do these things if you give me this money. And now he's doing them. And those things are bad.
Yeah.
But I think the experience of the world is still nonetheless.
But had that not happened, we would not have solved climate change. Yes, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's still a challenging issue. And even if we got rid of all these, you know, oil companies and gas companies in the U.S., mm-hmm. there would still be a lot of oil in the world. Mm-hmm. And we would still struggle to figure out how this would still be a challenging technical and social problem.
Yeah.
And that isn't to let decisions that these companies are making, it isn't to let them off the hook. And it isn't to kind of excuse ways that I think they've acted to the detriment of the American public.
Mm-hmm.
And it especially isn't to excuse, I think, the really heightened period of denialism that happened from, like, roughly 1988 or 1989 to kind of 2008. And that continues, you know, there are these companies still fund kind of pro fossil voices.
Sure, but it's just like it can be a problem that being the problem.
Exactly.
Yes.
This is not the main reason we haven't solved this problem.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I think that's an important thing to recognize, because we would still have a lot of these challenging questions around land use, around what local publics want,
mm-hmm.
around where we get energy from.
Yes. Well, on that depressing note, Rob, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
The Arguments production team includes Ranjini Chakraborty, Isabella Pereira, Angela Tracy, Kate Crawford, and Eli Richman. Our theme music is by Breakmaster Cylinder. If you want to hear more from The Argument, you can become a subscriber at theargumentmag.com.